Okay, I'd like to thank our speakers. It was a great set of presentations, and now we get to the fun part, the question and answer. And I forgot to mention one thing in my talk at the beginning. The Center for Peace and Liberty has been set up to study the ill effects of war, both on domestic and in foreign affairs. And one of our functions is to look at the domestic effects of war, and that's why we're having this forum on civil liberties. But we also do look at the ill effects of aggressive U.S. policies and excessive foreign interventions on other countries as well. So I just thought I'd mention that before the question and answer period because I forgot to do it beforehand. I'm going to take the prerogative of asking the first question, and I'll throw it open to the audience. My question to our panelists is, which provision, either in the Patriot Act or the executive actions after 9/11, do you think is most pernicious? In other words, which, if you had to repeal either an executive action or a provision of the Patriot Act, what would it be? In other words, what's the worst that's happened?
Am I supposed to start?
Well, you can. Yeah, you're over in this direction.
Okay, well, there's a lot of individual things in the Patriot Act which are mortifying, but one of the most things that I find most concerns me most is last May of 2002, Ashcroft canceled the restrictions on FBI surveillance of any place in the American public or almost any public group. These are restrictions that were put in place in 1976 after Congress found out what the FBI had done with COINTELPRO, in which the FBI was engaged in a massive subversion effort targeting at white hate groups, at black nationalist groups, at new left groups, and other targets, and they completely trampled these rights, the rights of these people. They had all kinds of entrapment efforts. They were sending poison pen letters to people's husbands and wives, trying to wreck marriages. They were getting teachers and professors fired for going to anti-war protests. They were wrecking anti-war protests. I mean, it's a chapter in American history that people should look at. Yes, there was some wonderful stuff in the Chronicle recently by Seth
Rosenfeld.
Yes, excellent stories. And this is the kind of stuff the FBI did. And these restrictions on FBI surveillance intrusion were put in place to stop those kind of outrages. Ashcroft not only canceled all of those restrictions and unleashed the FBI, but at the time he bragged that the FBI has a 94-year history of being champions and defenders of Americans' liberties. You know, it's hard to make this stuff up. So, anyhow.
Margaret, do you want to comment on that?
Yes, well, I think all of us had the initial reaction of, gee, there are 10 examples in our list of five worst. How do we cram them all in? But I guess I would certainly Section 215 and the threats to freedom of speech, I think, is one of the worst. And another that I'll mention is this whole very degrading registration process, focusing on people from about 20 different countries, that is just so humiliating, and I've spoken to many people affected by that. I think that's another action I would mention.
Okay, David?
I would say the immigration provisions, which I talked about earlier, which I think are the most sort of draconian in terms of civil liberties abuses that we would never tolerate if applied to ourselves, and so those are the ones. But I also think that the Patriot Act has become a symbol for the way the government has responded. But much of what the government has done, that is so objectionable, is not authorized by the Patriot Act. All of the preventive detention stuff that I talked about is not authorized by the Patriot Act, is simply the exploitation of pre-existing immigration law for purposes that it was never designed to serve. So I think even a total repeal of the Patriot Act, which Al Gore called for on Sunday, would not respond to the substantial amount of abuse that has occurred since September 11th. Most of the abuse is actually outside of, rather than inside, the Patriot Act.
Okay, now we'll turn it over to the audience here, and this gentleman right here. Oh, wait for the microphone. We have a microphone coming down here.
Try to hold it on his own.
Please make your questions brief so we give the...
I want to add what I think is a worse example, which I'm surprised nobody's talked about, and that's the provision or the government... The government, the president's saying that somebody is an enemy combatant, and then we have an American citizen and another person thrown into a brig somewhere in Virginia, gets no access to a lawyer, nothing, no trial, nothing, on the president's designation. That means anybody in this room, the president could say, David was an enemy combatant, and that's the last we'd ever see of him. Isn't that, that seems to me to be the worst infringement on our rights. It affects everybody.
I think that's right, and I think it's an example of what I was talking about in targeting foreign nationals first, and then using this as a precursor to extend to American citizens. But it was first used. Not with the American citizens, but with the people on Guantanamo. And they, too, are labeled as enemy combatants, denied access to a lawyer, denied access to courts, held incommunicado, held indefinitely. And the government's argument was, we can do this to them because they're foreign nationals. But then it discovered that one of them was a U.S. citizen. And then it picked up Jose Padilla at O'Hare Airport, and it found that it didn't have anything that could really charge him with. And so they extended this exact same practice to U.S. citizens. And now they defend the practice on the war power. And they say that it makes no difference whether you're a U.S. citizen or a foreign national. So this is an example where the government has already crossed the line from foreign nationals, the way that started, to U.S. citizens. But I can assure you that if history is any guide, each of the measures that have been deployed against foreign nationals will be ultimately extended to U.S. citizens. And it's only when they're extended to U.S. citizens that we will begin to recognize that they're wrong.
Okay, let's go back here to this gentleman here.
What concerns me is why are the campuses so quiet? And it's almost as if you need to be a meteorologist to see which way the wind's blowing these days rather than the way it used to be.
Margaret, do you want to comment on that?
Well, I guess we've all done such a good job raising this current generation. I'll say a little bit about law school environments. There is an organization called the Federalist Society that some of you may have heard about, a lot of, and they've really picked up a lot of steam on a number of law school campuses in an interesting way. And they started actually around the time that I was in law school. I think they started in 82. I graduated in 84. And they often present themselves as, we are sort of the discriminated against minority in campus life. But they have a way of influencing the debate so as to neutralize people who otherwise, I think, would feel very comfortable about being vocally activist in opposition. They neutralize the debate by saying, we're so marginalized, the Federalist Society is so discriminated against. And so what I've noticed in my law school and other law schools is a real flattening of any sense of debate in favor of this sort of notion of, on the one hand, on the other hand, let's be as ostensibly neutral as possible. So I think that's one influence. As far as undergraduates, I'm not as sure.
I wonder if I can comment on that?
Oh, sure.
You know, it is possible that the young Americans or Americans in general nowadays have much less enthusiasm for freedom than they used to have. So I hope not, but that's a possibility.
Okay. Let's go right back here in the back. The gentleman in the dark shirt here.
In reference to the timidity of the justices in this country and a lot of the judges who have kind of given over a whole lot of power to the executive branch. What is your prediction? I realize you don't have a crystal ball. The question goes out to the entire panel. The federal court or the Supreme Court will do, now that they've granted hearing on the Guantanamo Bay case, on the two issues. One, whether or not we even have the courts even have jurisdiction over Guantanamo Bay. And secondly, assuming that they say that they do, whether or not they will give back some of the constitutional rights that you would expect anybody that's being detained would have, right to counsel, right to access to family members, right to garner a defense, right to jury trial, those sort of things.
David, do you want to start on that?
I vowed never to make a prediction about the Supreme Court after Bush versus Gore. When every prediction I made at every step along the way was exactly wrong. So whatever I predict, you should disregard entirely. I think that all they're going to address is whether the court has jurisdiction. That's the only question that they're going to address, because the lower courts simply threw the cases out on jurisdictional grounds on the theory that these people, foreign nationals, have no rights and therefore and are not on U.S. soil and therefore can't seek habeas corpus jurisdiction. And that's the question that the court will take up. I think it will probably also take up, now that it has taken up this question, it will probably also take up the question of the U.S. citizen enemy combatants. The Hamdi case is up there on a petition for review. My guess is that they'll grant that. The Padilla case, who is the guy picked up at O'Hare Airport, is being argued on Monday in the Second Circuit on an expedited appeal, and so that will be decided relatively quickly. My guess is that they will take that. And so we're going to have the court addressing this question, you know, across the board. And there is something very unsettling about the government's position if you are a court. The government's position is it can lock up human beings indefinitely without legal limitation and without legal recourse. That is an extraordinary assertion of power. And we've seen now that it is not limited to foreign nationals, but extends to U.S. citizens. And if anything, it seems to me the sort of breadth of that assertion of authority is what has pushed the court to take this case on the Guantanamo detainees. Having taken it, however, they're going to be very nervous about the prospect of U.S. courts second-guessing military detentions in the course of a military conflict. And so, the best that I think we can hope for is something that says that the courts have some role to play here, leaving open the possibility for a very deferential review down the line. That's the best that we can hope for. This is not an activist court, at least on individual rights. On states' rights, it's been activist, but when it comes to human beings' rights, it's not particularly activist. And so I'm not optimistic about the outcome.
Anybody else want to comment on that?
Yeah, it's hard to know what the result's going to be, but it's going to be fun between now and then to watch Ashcroft sweat.
Okay, I've got a couple questions from our satellite rooms upstairs, and I want to make sure that we have people give our panelists a thorough grilling here. So I've got an interesting question. This is regards to the statement that Robert Kennedy arrested the mafia for littering, or spitting on the sidewalk, I guess. They heard it as littering, but anyway, is it not necessary to enforce all laws, even in non-traditional manners? If we could act more like Robert Kennedy, the Patriot Act would be deemed unnecessary. What's wrong with that logic?
I'm not sure I follow it, but the
well, he's saying if we enforced existing laws on a technical basis, we wouldn't need additional specialized.
I mean, the reality is that that laws we can't have full enforcement of all laws of any kind, and especially immigration laws. And we are a country that, number one, relies economically on illegal immigration. So we have always passed very extensive laws restricting immigration and putting extensive conditions on immigration, and we've always underfunded INS so that these laws cannot be fully enforced. That's a reality. It's also a reality that if they were fully enforced, not only would it be a hardship for our businesses that, like, you know, Walmart, that depend on illegal aliens to keep the prices down for us, but also it would be incredibly inhumane, because the only sanction that immigration law recognizes for a violation, no matter how technical the violation, is deportation from this country. And many people, who've lived here for very long periods of time, who have become part of the communities, who have some technical immigration violation, deporting them, separating them from their kids, who are often U.S. citizens because they're born here, et cetera, is just totally inhumane. And so it's, we've always had this sort of contradiction in our immigration law. And, in theory, yes, we shouldn't have, no one should break the law and everyone should be caught who breaks the law. But that's not the way it works. And so there's, in some sense, prosecution is always selective. What is problematic is that when prosecution is selective on the basis of protected status and protected activities like ethnic identity and religious practice, when we start engaging in zero tolerance immigration enforcement, not against the immigrants, illegal immigrants across the board, but against Arabs and Muslims only, that, it seems to me, is morally and constitutionally wrong, and I think it's also been proven thus far to be highly ineffective. We have not, through this kind of enforcement, identified al-Qaeda members, identified real terrorists, made this country safer.
Okay, you've had your hand up right here. Just wait for the microphone a second. I'll be right up here a second.
My question to the panel is, what are your legal rights if you refuse to be searched at an airport? And secondly, are you aware of the status of several lawsuits challenging searches at airports?
As far as legal rights, the primary legal right you have is the legal right not to fly. Because that's how it's going to work out. That's the long and short of it. But it's actually worse than that, because there was a new regulation put in place shortly after 9/11 that if someone even raises their voice to one of these TSA agents, federal agents doing the screening now, the person could be arrested for that. And there have been a number of cases where people would say a single harsh word to the person who had been hassling them in their perspective, and boom, the person is handcuffed and led away. Someone asked me recently if I felt more secure when I'm traveling, going through airports, and I said, the chance of me being arrested are much higher in airports now, with regulations like this. So there are some lawsuits, I think, but I don't think that they've gotten very far, and I don't expect them to go very far, unfortunately.
Yeah, can I just mention two suits of relevance, not strictly about searches, because I think you are right. It would be, well, you cannot fly. In Northern California, there was filed by the ACLU a suit challenging the no-fly list that had been discovered and was being used against individuals in a very strange manner. I mean, two of the plaintiffs are co-editors of a newspaper called Peace Times, and they got to the airport ready to board their plane, and they find out that they can't fly because they're on the special list. What list is it? Oh, well, it's sort of a no-fly list. And so the gist of that suit is really to get information under the Freedom of Information Act about what this list is, how people get on it. That's one suit. A second issue, not a lawsuit, which you can find more information about on the ACLU website, aclu.org, with a quiz, has to do with the administration's floating of this idea of ranking people by security color, red, yellow, green, etc., so that when you arrive at the airport and get ready to fly, based on certain indicia, not completely revealed, you may be ranked as, stoplight go, maybe. And this is also a very interesting development, because it means if you go take the quiz on the website, you're asked a series of questions, actually, to give you more information about people who have been stopped and what they know about the reasons why they've been stopped. So,
can I have a very different perspective on this, on the airport situation. I think it's a good thing that many of us get searched when we go through the airports. I do feel safer because the government is subjecting us to much more careful screening than they were before. I think that's a good thing. And I think that actually, putting aside the ethnic profiling, which is targeted, the kind of general approach to airport security has been one in which we've struck the balance in a fairly reasonable way. We have tried to increase security, but we've done it in ways that try to minimize the burdens on travelers. Why? Because this affects all of us. We all want to be safe on planes, but we all also want to maintain our dignity and not have to show up at the airport 3 hours in advance. And so here, you have people, you know, the citizenry's interest is in both in security and in liberty, and I think we've done a fairly okay job with those across the board measures. So I think that's an example of how we need to respond. I mean, I think it's wrong to say we don't need to do anything different after 9/11. I think we do have to do things differently, but we have to think about them smartly, and we also have to be willing to share the burdens equally. And so, to me, the airport is actually an example of something where the government has done it right. Now, obviously, it has not made traveling entirely safe, and it's impossible to make traveling on airplanes entirely safe. But I think it's done some fairly important moves in checking baggage, et cetera, in checking people more thoroughly. And I think that the across the board thing is something that we should herald, not something that we should criticize.
Anybody else want to comment on that?
I'd have a lot of comments on that. You know, as far as sharing the burdens equally, you know, it's not really progress to make a large number of people miss their flights. Back shortly after 9/11, the transportation secretary said we set a goal of 5 minutes for waiting. At National Airport, last week, there were 45-minute lines coming out through Dulles Airport. Yesterday, the lines were 20, 25 minutes. A lot of people were missing their flights, and they were not more secure because of it. And not only that, but, you know, TSA is a joke. You know, TSA is one of the biggest farces of this war on terrorism. I mean, it was fascinating to see how that college kid, it's fascinating to see how a college kid, 20 years old, can fly on Southwest and send emails to the TSA telling him what he had done, telling him where this stuff was hidden, which flights, exactly what planes were on. It takes the TSA 5 weeks to respond. 5 weeks. I mean, and they were saying, well, you know, we have a lot of email coming in, you know. maybe they should hire people who read English. I don't know.
Well, I'd like to make a little comment on that, too. I think we have to look at some of these provisions and not just assume that the government is taking the right steps. You're mentioning some of it. The other thing is there's a lot of security problems in the luggage handling and the employees. If you're a terrorist, you try to find the weakest link in the system. And so, of course, the passengers have been, you know, frisked and had their luggage rifled through and everything else. So the passengers, they're not going to take that route. And I think that's not to say that the terrorists are, you know, godlike, but certainly they're going to try to move around the system and find weaknesses in the system. So I'm not sure that that the government always takes the right approach. If you remember, after September 11th, they had 18-year-old kids at airports with assault rifles. That didn't make me feel very happy, because if you're going to have somebody at an airport, at least have somebody with a pistol, because you don't want to mow down all the passengers while you're trying to get one terrorist running through the airport. And I don't think there's ever been a terrorist that tried to go through the checkpoint. So it didn't make any sense. And of course, they eventually figured out that it was kind of scaring people. And I think I was scared. They said there weren't any bullets in the gun, and I was just hopeful that there wasn't. So, you know. But okay, you, sir, here.
Yeah, let's face it. Our airport security is a fiasco. It is false security. It is only window dressing. Let me give you an example. The main source of designing the hassles, the constant harassment of people going through as passengers, is the past. Every cockeyed thing that has been done for the last 30 years by a terrorist is designed into our current system, and nothing from the future. Let me give you an example. There is no, as far as I can tell, no added security to the fuel terminals and fuel trucks of our airports. So let me just give you the way these people think. All they need is a truck, four guys and a few guns. They take the truck through a gate, they smash their way through, shoot the people on these low-lying fuel trucks that you see, and they know when there are loaded planes at the terminal. They drive one up under the wing of a plane, drive it into the wheel so the plane can't move, and blow the thing, and you've got four burning aircraft right there. Perfect example of a simple, easy way they can do it, completely bypassing this window dressing that is resulting primarily in the bankrupting of various different airlines. There is a word for where we are headed with our airline system. It is Aeroflot. I've flown on it. I don't like it, and that's where we're headed. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the comment. We're gonna put you on Ashcroft's terrorist list after that little plan.
I just hope no one has to get on a flight tonight.
Okay, this guy here, right in the back here.
Given that you all would like to trash the Patriot Act, are there any provisions of it or any other provisions that you would use to tighten up security in light of what happened on 9/11? Would you want to just keep things the way they were, as inept as they were prior to that event?
Actually, there are a few provisions in the Patriot Act that are not necessarily bad things. There are a few minor things which update some of the wiretap laws to make account for some new technologies. Those are not necessarily subversive of the Fourth Amendment or people's privacy. There are little bits and pieces. There are some that are simply minor adjustments that are not horrible things, and those kind of things are not threats to our freedom and could be left on the books. So,
I think there's actually a fair amount in the Patriot Act that's not objectionable. I mean, it was a 342-page bill. And even if you read the 342 pages, you won't get it because it says, you know, on page one, it says Section 375 of Article 1 will be amended to change an and to an or. So you've got to get the whole U.S. code and put it down. But when you actually look at it, there's plenty in there that's not particularly controversial from a civil liberties perspective. There are a lot of it is money laundering provisions, which the banks complain about because they have to report a lot more than they had before, but it's not a civil liberties problem particularly. I think the provision that for roving wiretaps is not, I don't find that to be that problematic. It is simply saying that when, you know, in the era of cell phones, when people can buy a new phone anytime they want to, if you show that someone is doing that, you can get a roving wiretap, which permits you to tap phones that person might reasonably use. That seems to me to be reasonable. We already had it for drug crimes, et cetera. And I also think that the provision which authorizes the prosecutors in grand jury investigations that come across evidence that's relevant to international terrorism to share that information with the CIA, et cetera, is a perfectly reasonable provision. So I think, of course, we have to do more. And I think it's wrong to be simply critical and say, we don't need to do anything more. But I think you need to think about what's smart in responding to the threats that we face. And simply giving the government broader powers to gather more information without adequate objective showings of criminal suspicion is not the way to go. And so the surveillance provisions that do that, I think, are problematic. As I've said before, the immigration provisions are very problematic. But I think it's overkill to say that the whole thing is wrong. I mean, what Al Gore said was, we should, even though there are provisions in it that are okay, we should just repeal the whole thing because it was passed in such a cockamamie way that we should start from ground zero. And that argument I could see as making sense, but I don't think it'll ever hold water. The only hope we have really is to target the provisions that are most controversial and try to amend those, which is what the SAFE Act does.
Do you have any comments on the money laundering?
Yes, I do. You know, there's a chapter here in Terrorism and Tyranny on the money laundering cases. And to see how the feds, the first person convicted under the Patriot Act, the Patriot Act had a provision which said that if you're running a money forwarding service and you don't have a state license, then that's a federal felony. You know, and they used this to go after a lot of Somalis and Somali Americans who were transferring money back home. And they went into these raids, they confiscated people's life savings, and they greatly disrupted the transfer of money from Somali expatriates to their relatives back home. There were probably some people that died because of that. And there were a lot of innocent people who got smeared. And the first person to be convicted of the Patriot Act was a Somali guy who had been investigated by the FBI the previous year to see whether there was any terrorist connection to his money forwarding service. FBI found nothing. They had no evidence on the guy, except that he had started to fill out the paperwork to get this state license, and he had not finished it. And that's how they nailed him. And it was a fascinating scene in the federal court, because the federal judge who handed down the sentence, he was outraged because a federal prosecutor came in there and wanted a very harsh sentence for this guy, far harsher than what the sentencing guidelines called for, and because the prosecutor portrayed the guy as a terrorist financier. And the judge was furious. He said, you know, there's no evidence of this. I mean, this is outrageous what you've done to this guy.
What was the sentence?
The sentence, I think it was, it's in here, maybe 32 months or somewhere like that. But the feds, the prosecutor wanted a much larger, much longer sentence. But there's a really wonderful quote from the judge, which I don't recall right now. But it's in chapter 5.
David? One thing I might add here is the way the current system of TSA works is, of course, is that everyone who flies is a suspected terrorist. You're searched without due process, et cetera, et cetera. You have no property rights. They can rifle through your luggage, et cetera, et cetera. The idiocy of the situation can be contrasted with the situation in most other fields in which people essentially are pre-screened. In other words, an airline faces insurance risk. Airports face insurance risk. They want to minimize the risk for the people who are using those facilities. There's absolutely no reason at all why people could not apply for pre-screening. They're approved before they enter the airport. They can pay a fee. There could be a competitive market for this kind of thing. And there's a huge demand for it. It's no different from credit ratings or anything else. But the government essentially proscribes this because everyone has to go through this Orwellian system of being searched without limit whenever you try to fly. The problem basically is the government doesn't know who the terrorists are or where to find them, and so we are all suspects. That's the absurdity of the situation.
Okay, I just want to, that we got a question from upstairs that was a little bit broader than your question. How do you think the U.S. should handle the terrorist problem if not through the Patriot Acts 1 and 2? This goes outside are there other things that we could do to make ourselves safer?
Yeah, well, first and foremost is stop creating so many new terrorists. U.S. foreign policy is breeding terrorists. If you look at what's happening in Iraq, I mean, think back a year ago, Americans were not being attacked in so-called terrorist attacks in Iraq a year ago. American troops were not dying there. Italian troops were not dying there. The Jordanian embassy had not been blown up. But there's far more killings going on now that we've gone there. And we've made ourselves a magnet for intense hatred with our policies, and our policies before the Bush invasion with the sanctions, our heavy intervention in the Middle East. There are some neoconservatives are calling for World War IV as a way to finally solve the terrorist problem. Well, it's not going to solve any problems. It's going to kill a lot more people and make a lot more enemies. I mean, the most important thing which we can do is stop all the unnecessary foreign interventions, stop making all these, stop breeding so much foreign hatred.
Just to amplify that point, when the neoconservatives and others who are proponents of profligate U.S. interventions overseas, they always say, well, we're attacked for who we are. But if you look at the public opinion polls in the Arab and Muslim world, poll after poll says that the people in those countries like our culture, they like our economic and political freedoms. But the snag to all that, the question that always gets a really low rating is, what about our foreign policy, and particularly to the Middle East? So whenever you hear the president say, well, they hate our freedoms, the polling doesn't indicate that they hate our freedoms. In fact, we're looked on as a model in that area. But we're not looked on as a model in the foreign policy area.
I would just add that when you look at, in my book, I look at the foreign reactions to the double standard that we've employed at home. And I think, you know, the flip side of the unilateral foreign policy, in which we say we can do whatever we want because we play by our own rules, because we have the biggest guns, is the approach at home, where we say we want certain rights for ourselves, but we're willing to deny them to these other human beings who happen not to have U.S. passports. Well, that becomes a tremendous point of critique for mainstream newspapers and government officials around the world, and that undermines the legitimacy of what we're doing and trying to protect ourselves, and I think contributes to this anti-Americanism, which I agree with James is really the greatest threat to national security that we face today.
Okay, let's go with this gentleman over here. This has got to be our last question because we're running out of time here.
Yeah, I just wanted to know what you thought about this idea that just came to my mind while I was sitting here, talking about the Patriot Act, and what can make us, you know, safer. And I was wondering what you thought about, didn't we already have an original Patriot Act, and wasn't that called the Bill of Rights? And that I see the Patriot Act of today actually trashing the original Patriot Act, which is the Bill of Rights. And if we're all given our full rights as stated in the Bill of Rights, then we would be much safer today. We wouldn't have to be worrying about these new, you know, pseudo-Patriot Acts making us unsafer. So I was wondering what you thought about the original Patriot Act actually being the Bill of Rights, and we should be guaranteed these as natural rights, not privileges that the government can grant and take away.
It sounds pretty radical.
Anybody else got a comment on that? Okay, well, with that, we've run out of time. I'd like to thank everybody for coming, and David wants to say something before everybody leaves.
I want to thank again, I want to thank Ivan and Bridget for organizing our event this evening. And I also want to particularly thank all of our speakers for joining with us. If you join with me in a round of applause. I want to encourage you all to get both copies of our books that are featured tonight. These are very serious issues. The repercussions, the implications are enormous. You'll also find other books upstairs relating to many of these questions. I also wanted to point out one other book, if I could, which I've mentioned to some of you in the past, which is a book called Crisis and Leviathan. It's written by another one of our senior fellows, Robert Higgs, who also edits our journal, The Independent Review. If you want to understand the nature of state power and how that relates to crises, especially war crises, this is the book that you should read. So thank you again for joining with us and making this a very successful event. Again, the books are upstairs, and I know our authors would be happy to autograph copies. Thank you and good night.